Hello, hello, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to another episode of the Daily Friend Wrap. I'm your host, Nicholas Larimer, today joined by Herman Pretorius. Today we're going to be talking a little bit about the ANC's election campaign for the local government elections. Is it in collapse already? We're also going to be talking about employment equity targets in the new Employment Equity Amendment Act. Those targets are coming into came into effect yesterday. And we're also going to be talking about a incident of crime and also capital, but get into that later in the show. So, with at least a year out from the ANC's local government election, or from the local government election in South Africa, we don't know entirely when it's going to be. It's either going to be sort of maybe November, December, January, February, 2026, 2027, that part of the year. And yet, the ANC is once again in organizational crisis. We had reporting recently that the ANC is facing legal battles over unpaid invoices with a company on Sunday, revealing that it has taken the ANC to court over 20 million rands apparently unpaid from a bunch of invoices in terms of work that communications company did for the ANC during an election campaign. And Herman, we have to kind of ask the question. This is, the ANC had massive problems like this before the last election, and they sort of managed to kind of solve some of them before the election actually came. But, there were still many outstanding problems. Has the campaign already collapsed, or is that a little bit too over the top?
I must say, I was rather tickled by this headline because this idea of an election campaign collapses is clearly there to be a bit clickbaity. It's not completely dishonest, but I do think there's a flavor of sort of spreading the butter really quite thick on this particularly toasted slice of bread. Now, the thing is that this is probably the third election cycle that we've seen these headlines cripple the ANC out of the gate. This goes back to 2019, left some unpaid debts going into 2021. Between 2021, 2024, and now 2024 to 26, 7. And it's interesting because this has now become standard. It is sort of part of the ANC's story, is they can't pay debts that they have from previous campaigns. Quite often it's catering, quite often it's marketing, and they have problems paying their staff on time. Now, when you consider why it's important for a party to have money, and not many people think about what actually is the point of money in an election campaign. There's sort of a conspiratorial instinct of, oh, you want money for an election campaign. Ugh. And then you don't really think further as to what the money is supposed to accomplish. But a small example of what the difference is between a party with money and a party without money. In January 2024, with its annual rally around the January 8th statement, the ANC's campaign was heading into the final months of the election campaign for national and government, national and provincial government, and then legislatures. But there was a bus accident near Mahubas Kloof where seven ANC activists died. And afterwards, investigating the vehicle accident, someone from that branch, from that part of the ANC, said the problem here is that activists and delegates and members don't have secure transport because the party cannot afford it any longer. So people have to get to the rallies at their own expense. And this person, this anonymous source, says, and that is why these ANC activists died, because they had to take unsafe, unreliable late night bus services. So the difference between a party having money and a party not having money is twofold. Number one, the logistical component. Can you get people to your rallies? Can you have a show of force? Can you have the necessary material in terms of t-shirts so that you create an enticing picture? Because for parties like the EFF, ANC, MK, shows of force, and to a lesser extent the DA as well, but shows of force in rally terms, mass events, vitally important. It shows that you are a movement of the people. You tap into the psychology of having this sort of popular groundswell, this grassroots presence. So number one, it's you need money to get people to those events. Number two, you need to be able to make sure that those events are branded and that when you look out over the crowd, when the camera pans around, you see green, yellow and black and not, you know, sort of random colors. It's strong for the branding messaging. But then it's also for just the maintenance of making sure that your crowd sticks around for the few hours of the rally, because quite often you would have party leaders speak late in the events. And the EFF, towards the end of the election campaign, had trouble keeping their activists at the campaign events because they didn't have enough water and stuff. So then Malema would start speaking and there would be visuals of people leaving the stadium. So it's that's sort of the vibes that you need to create visually.
Yeah.
On the other hand, you also have this problem of ensuring that people are safe, that people are looked after. So you need to make sure that your morale is kept high. And if people can't afford to get to the event, or if it's unsafe to get there, or if people die getting to these events, it's really bad for party morale. So at this stage, if you're looking at an election campaign, the two things that you want to be able to make sure of is that you're building a message and that you're building morale. And both of those two things are directly connected to the ability of a party to fundraise. So the question about the ANC's fundraising capability this early is such a direct red flag to both the capacity, the ability to run a campaign, and the morale of the staff that you will need to see it through. So this is why it is so critical. 20 million rand debt might not sound massive in terms of the ANC's, you know, usual spending of hundreds of millions of rands a year. But the reality is quite intriguing that election campaign collapse shoved into the headline there is perhaps a bit sensationalist, but it speaks to a deeper truth of a party really in trouble from the get-go.
Right. We don't know their finances. I mean, you know, we don't know how much of this is the party generally out of money. Is this, you know, like so much that we see from government and the ANC these days of just like administrative incompetence? You know, they didn't pay the thing. Are they disputing it with this company spuriously because they're unhappy with the services provided, whatever? But it just speaks to just chaos, disorganization, and all those sort of problems. And then, of course, you know, all the things you mentioned. The other thing is online advertising, influencers, radio waves, adverts, billboards. There's so many things that help you to build that image of just this like powerful organization that is everywhere. Get your message across. Yeah, it's going to be fascinating to watch as this unfolds over the next things. And you know, there was a time when I think the ANC was outspending the DA so much in election campaigns that it was spending like more on T-shirts than the whole ANC election, than the whole DA and election budget.
Those days are gone. Yes, and that's as recently as 2016, 2019, when, you know, the ANC was spending orders of magnitude. But if we look at the political donation disclosures recently, DA ahead of the ANC by some margin. Now, of course, that's complicated by the fact that the ANC funnels everything through Chancellor House Holdings, right, through Luthuli House. So you can't really get a good sense. But at this stage, particularly heading into a local government election campaign where the ANC is notoriously weaker, they struggle to get their activists out. National and provincial campaigns, very much the ANC's stronger suit. So not only do they face the headwinds of financial difficulties increasingly biting at their, you know, capacity to run a campaign, it's also heading into the type of election that typically hurts the ANC. So that all these things are starting to align that could genuinely put us at a position where the DA and the ANC meet each other at the 30% mark for the first time in a general election.
And then, of course, the other painful exercise the ANC is going to have to go through is, and this always ends up in drama and violence and that kind of thing, is the selection of councillor candidates for wards across the country. You know, there's still many parts of the country where those are safe seats where the ANC is not going to be challenged. You know, I'm thinking like rural Limpopo, places like that. And that always causes factionalism. Sometimes it results in violence and murders. It's always, you know, the ANC always has this like kind of reluctance to even start the process because it's so difficult for them to manage. So we still have to see that process, which is also going to cause major problems for the party. And you're no doubt going to see a few months from now, some ANC municipality or branch or something declaring that they're not campaigning anymore because the wrong person was chosen as this candidate or that candidate. So the problems have only begun. Interesting stuff to watch. Okay, back to policy stuff. Unfortunately, yesterday was the implementation of various race and gender quotas due to the expansion of the minister's powers by the Employment Equity Amendment Act. Basically, at the beginning of the year, government set all these targets to come into force on September 1st for every sector of the economy. It's essentially an attempt to micromanage the demographics of the whole economy or most of the economy. This is every sector with companies over 50 employees have to comply with having a certain number of people of a certain race or a certain gender at various levels of management. It's like an entire sort of bureaucratic exercise just to organize who's who and who's what. The idea here is to basically get companies to do the legwork for government to classify their own employees, which is a dubious process to begin with. And then if companies don't comply, they could potentially be fined enormous amounts of money, which can cripple the company completely. So, Herman, not great for the economy. There are various court challenges against these regulations and employment. I've seen in the show today, one of the things we read before this was the DA challenging these in court. I know that Sachliche has also been taking this stuff to court. What's your take on all of this?
So, firstly, what is important to understand in terms of why this is a change from the previous employment equity situation is that the sectoral targets this time move beyond voluntary guidelines to mandatory numerical targets, quotas, essentially, for the first time. So this is quite a change. This isn't employment equity as it's been going on for the last 20 years. This is an aggravation of that policy to a really, really worrying extent. And I've already had a meeting with some colleagues, with at least one company, a technology company, a startup in South Africa, built from the ground up over the last 20 years in South Africa. And they have now decided that they are moving to Germany over the next 2 to 5 years, precisely because of this policy that came into a brutal force on the 1st of September yesterday. So, I mean, that's just one anecdotal piece of evidence of an employer with more than 50 people on the payroll upping and leaving. So we could, within the next few years, add those 50 jobs to the unemployment register, thanks to particularly these employment equity targets, race quotas, essentially, and gender quotas. And what this business person told me is that they've been bending backwards, was his phrase. They've been bending backwards on BEE, on employment equity, just trying to make it work because they aren't ideologues. They don't do the politics of it. They do business. They want to be able to make money, expand, employ more people, grow their market share, and, you know, just that virtuous cycle of making sure that you deliver services or goods that people want to pay money for. The more you deliver, the more client base you build, the more you can expand your offering, deliver more. It's just that virtuous cycle of really economic growth at the SME scale. Now, across 18 economic sectors and at the four levels of occupational management. You've got top management, senior management, professionally qualified and middle management people, and skilled technical roles. So this really reaches from not quite the lowest rungs of an organization, you know, your unskilled labor, not quite at that level, but immediately kicks in at technical skill, technical roles, takes it up all the way to the CEO level. So it's about, I would say, between 70 and 80% of a company would be subject to this. Number one, hard numerical targets, hard race quotas, hard gender quotas. These quotas are bizarrely connected to the EAP, the economically active population. Now, the reality is quite stark, where ASISA, one of the representative bodies of financial asset managers in South Africa, have made the case to the government, to the Department of Employment and Labour, saying, look, chaps, the economically active population, if we break it down by these numerical targets, by race and gender quotas, it is impossible for us to find the necessary skills for the sector as it is and for the sector as it will grow over the next 5 years. They would need to appoint hundreds of thousands of employees that are not qualified, because if you're part of the economically active population, it doesn't mean that you are suitable for employment in the financial sector necessarily. Just because you're the client of, say, a bank doesn't mean you can work for said bank. So you've got the economically active population, let's say 7% of them is of group X or Y, but in terms of the employee scope from where this sector can appoint people, only 2% of available workers are of that particular identity. Now you've got a shortfall of 5 percentage points, for example, where the economically active population and the people who you can feasibly appoint in your sector is not in proportion to each other. But because the targets are based on the economically active population, you must adhere to the larger target, even though the literal skills supply in the country isn't up to scratch, isn't large enough, isn't big enough for you to be able to make those appointments. That is the absurdity that we have here with using the economically active population with this social engineering. And what makes it even more sinister and quite dark is this is where we're full scale back at the pencil tests of the Population Registration Act. The Population Registration Act of 1950 was the cornerstone law of apartheid that essentially says you are a white person if you have these ancestors within these few generations, or you are black if you have these ancestors within these. And so it had a very, very crude, almost Nuremberg law type of categorization for when you were of which race. How tall you were, your hair texture could be taken into consideration. That's where the pencil test comes from, in the sense that African hair has a different texture to Caucasian hair. So if a pencil is stuck into your hairdo and it stays there, it is an indication of the texture. That's where it comes from. And this law was repealed in 1991, which was a very good thing. But now the Employment Equity Act and these regulations have put racial classification, not voluntary, mandatory racial classification, fully and squarely and indubitably back on the table. They hide behind this idea that, oh, it's self-classification. The employees must classify themselves. But if you look deeper and if you ask questions as we've been asking, the result that you get to is mandatory racial classification by either the companies, which is in not a fair labor practice and in contravention of the Constitution, or by the department, i.e. the state. And race audits are now mandatory for organizations or companies with 50 employees and above. So this isn't just, you know, a smallish change of, you know, we've been dealing with employment equity for 20 years. No, no, no. This is making it far more intrusive, far more aggressive, far more damaging. It is mandatory. It is quite sick. It is sweeping. And you mentioned the punitive measures. Non-compliance risks orders and fines ranging from 1.5 million rand or 2% of turnover for a first offense, or 2.7 million rand or 10% of turnover for repeated offenses. This isn't profit. This is turnover. And if you are in a sector where profit and is just a sliver of turnover, as is the case in many under pressure sectors, then your profit will be wiped out by, because let's put it in context, in retail, in grocery chains, if you have a profit margin of 8%, then you're bloody happy. You know, if you make 8 cents on the rand profit, then you are a massive success story. Your shareholders will, you know, just be over the moon. This takes that idea of the 2 to 10% of turnover, eradicates any profit you might make. It eats into your operational capital. So it is crippling in the extreme. So we are in a situation where four things can happen. Companies can ignore and get away with it because the state might not have the appetite or ability to enforce these draconian targets. That's sort of the best case scenario. Still horrible because it already is having a chilling effect on the economy. Or you can be in a situation where these companies just simply go, we don't have time for this nonsense. This isn't what we came into business for. We're closing down shop. All companies can simply cut to be below the 50-person employee mark, in which case jobs will get lost or jobs won't be created that could have been created. All these companies will fight the hardcore fight all the way to court and win, or finally they will fight and they will lose. In all four of these cases, even in the best case scenario, what you're looking at here is either capital freezes, capital confiscations, capital departure, or the loss of or massive opportunity cost in terms of expanding capital. This is sick. It is illegal. It is unconstitutional. It is desperate. It is aggressive. And it is something that a brittle economy like South Africa cannot afford. The IRR will be continuing our campaign against this. We will be supporting court cases. We don't go to court primarily. That's not really our style. Our way is more to make sure that the arguments delivered in court by others is of substance. And we are glad to report that we are seeing some of our own arguments being incorporated into existing cases, whether it's the DA or Sakaliha. But the IRR will continue our campaign against this, and people cannot, must not, should not underestimate the gravity of the situation. It is toxic. It is dangerous. And it needs to be defeated.
Two very quick things to add. One of the problems with the legislation is it also gives the minister, I believe, quite significant powers to exempt companies. So this creates a situation where government can essentially go to any company that's not compliant, as you've just laid out. You know, there's all these problems with complying, and say, oh, well, nice company you got here. Be a shame if we investigated you for non-compliance. Maybe you should do what we want you to do on some other thing. Maybe a certain donation to a certain political party could be of great value to your ability to avoid inspection and prosecution on this. So there's a sort of whole corruption aspect as well baked into this. And then also, you know, there's going to be a tendency from some defenders of this stuff to say, oh, look, you know, it's just two white men on a podcast, you know, complaining about racial redress and justice. And of course, one of the darkly amusing and horrifying parts of this legislation is that it doesn't just, you know, target minority groups or whatever. There have been cases in the past where similar types of laws have been used against Black South Africans. They'll say, oh, well, you know, we've got too many Black females in this profession, therefore we can, you know, we only have space for Black males or for a colored female or something like that. This is what happens when you micromanage the whole economy and, you know, sort of try to demographically organize the whole of society. It's not going to work. It's impossible. You are going to run over people even the people you are pretending to help.
And there's no evidence to think this will help the economy or racial inequality. None whatsoever.
Right.
So
this is going to hurt primarily poor people. And because most poor people are black, it will hurt mostly black South Africans.
Yeah. And you mentioned that there have been already cases where these types of rules have cost black South Africans. These aren't pre-1994 things. This is like 2016-17, where I think it was the Cape Bar Council had sort of these rules about the composition of their sort of managing authority. And there was a black advocate who received more votes than a female black advocate who received more votes to serve on this council than a white colleague. But because her quota, because the black female quota was already filled, she wasn't elected. And the person with fewer votes of the quote, right race to match the structural engineering of this racial situation got elected. So we shouldn't think that this is sort of some obscure corner. And you know what, Nick, ironically, the two of us, we won't be affected by this in terms of losing our jobs. Our organization isn't large enough. So this isn't us, my future prospects. We're think tankers, you know, we're quite happy where we are. But what this will do is it will rip out the heart of small business or small to large business in South Africa. It will divert costs that should be going to economically productive spend, and it'll just, you know, dump it into this toxic waste of structural racial engineering. So it is incredibly, incredibly dangerous. And it gives off more than just a stench of apartheid.
All right, let's move to our last story. And this is one of those bizarre stories that I just want to know more about. Relatively recently, Arms Corps, which supplies arms to the South African military, had a heist at its storage house at the Simonstown naval base. According to police and some of the reporting on this, there are suspicions that a security guard working at the dockyard basically let some people in to steal arms. The Navy said that this was Arms Corps' responsibility, and they sort of seem to imply that it wasn't their fault. Something had been stolen from, you know, South Africa's quote highly secure base in Simonstown. And you know, the story wouldn't be that interesting if that's all that happened. But weirdly, someone sent a video to News 24 of a group of villagers who were preparing for a traditional ceremony in the Eastern Cape, confronting the suspects of this crime. Now, it's not entirely clear from the reporting how exactly they got caught, but basically what happened is a group of villagers in the Eastern Cape, about 1,000 kilometers away, these guys, I presume, lived there or had relatives there, came there, and the villagers figured out that they had done this crime and then began interrogating them and filmed the interrogation. This is translated from Xhosa, but in the video, one suspect says, "We ran from Cape Town, we robbed guns at the Navy base," and sort of trying to defend himself, the suspect says, "We did not hurt anyone. We went to the base because prior arrangements were made with people working there." The villagers are heard gasping in shock. One of them says, "What did you do with the guns here in the village?" To which they say, "Nothing." They then were asked whether they had pointed a firearm at someone during the night. And the suspect said, "My friend over here was involved in an argument. I was only trying to stop it." They're also asked if they were involved in stock theft, a charge that they denied. And then one of the villagers in the background says, "Oh, so you only kill people for money then?" They've been handed over to Eastern Cape Police, who have confirmed the arrest and say that these men are linked to crimes in the Western Cape. Preliminary investigations revealed the suspects are from the Western Cape and have pending cases ranging from robberies in the province. All suspects appeared in the magistrate's court on the 25th of August and remain in custody. So, you know, obviously the difficult part now is making sure that they all go to jail, but this is sort of, I mean, I don't know how they got caught. But, you know, in terms of vigilantism, this is one of the better vigilantism stories. Nobody was killed or set alight or anything like that. People were handed over to the cops. And, you know, ordinary South Africans did the work that the police should be doing and were, you know, you could hear how angry and pissed off they were.
And there are so many components of this story that is just in and of itself newsworthy, but that they are compiled into this sort of niche Sunday afternoon drama of South Africa's experience is quite astonishing. Now, firstly, I think there is the blatant incompetence of our armed forces. And one of the stories we chose not to talk about today is the military exercises we'll be carrying out alongside Russia and China, just as the G20 summit is underway in South Africa. And the more I think about it, the more I think we could be sleeper agents for the West, in the sense that our incompetence in terms of our military ability might be such that we sink a few Russian and Chinese ships, or accidentally shoot down a few choppers, or wipe out a few units by sheer incompetence. And one wonders what our role in the military exercises will be, whether it will be just, you know, tying our shoes and the Chinese and the Russians going, well done, that's a good exercise that you're doing there. So firstly, there's just the incompetence part that is absolutely staggering. Secondly, there is the fact that they traveled 1,000 kilometers without raising any suspicion, without being tracked, seemingly. Then there's the question that it was ordinary people that apprehended them and confronted them. But what is really colorful to me about this picture is how that little exchange that you read out captures what matters to ordinary South Africans. Are you a danger to my community? I.e., are you pointing guns at people here, living here? Are you threatening us? And number two, are you part of a stock theft cartel? I.e., are you threatening our livelihoods? So it's lives and livelihoods. It's the material circumstances that even within the pathetic opera of stolen military cargo, the stuff that would be enough to end an administration in other countries, even within the context of the absurdity of that, there's a very real earthiness to the concerns that arise from an ordinary South African's perspective. Are you threatening us? Are you threatening our socioeconomic ability, our material circumstances? So I love this story in the sense that it is so proudly South African. It could happen nowhere else in the world. And as you say, this is sort of good vigilantism. It's always almost tired vigilantism of really, could you just take a route and travel in sort of an obscene manner? So now I must say, the story touches on so many levels, but what I love about it is there's something really healthy about how the villagers in the Eastern Cape just responded to people who robbed a military base, and it was just, you know, don't come here with your nonsense to our community, you vile scumbags. Please take your military stolen goods elsewhere. We don't have time for it here. I think that reflects something quite quaint about the South African characteristic.
And with that, we'll call it to a close. Thank you very much for listening. We hope you enjoyed, and we'll see you tomorrow on The Daily Friend Show. Cheers, everyone. The Daily Friend Show and The Daily Friend are a project of the Institute of Race Relations, the IRR. The IRR is a think tank which was founded in 1929 to study race relations in South Africa and works to change government policy to improve race relations through non-racialism and to ensure the prosperity of all South Africans. If you like our work and would like to support us, please go to irr.org.za and click Support the IRR. Or you can go to thedailyfriend.co.za and click the Fund Us button.